Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello there, welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. This is an interlull Arsecast. That's right. We don't always do an Arsecast during the interlull because there isn't much to talk about, because normally the Friday Arsecast revolves around the game that we've got coming up at the weekend. We don't have a game coming up at the weekend. We also haven't had a game in midweek to look back on. So normally we let it pass. And I'm sure if you listen to the Arsecast Extra on Monday, myself and James did 90 minutes talking about West Brom and talking about the whole situation at this football club. And I was thinking about this podcast and going, you know, I just can't do another conversation about Arsene Wenger. What's gone wrong? What can he do to fix it? Is he the man to fix it? Is he not the man to fix it? Should he stay? Should he go? Is he going to stay? Is he going to go? Where the hell is Ivan Gazidis? Where's Stan Kroenke? Does anybody really care where Stan Kroenke is? Could he do more nothing than he's doing already? What about the coaches? What about the players? And, you know, we've done it. Everything that we needed to say about this current situation at Arsenal, James and I said on the Arsecast Extra on Monday. So it would be just like rehashing what we already talked about, because nothing much has happened this week. And anyway, I've been writing about it all week on arseblog.com. So what is the point in me doing another podcast in which we talk about the same things and come to more or less the same conclusions about what should happen and probably what won't happen, etc., etc.? There's no point. No point me putting you through that. You've lived it and experienced it the same way that I have this week through reading it and listening to the podcast and just generally being an Arsenal fan. So we need something a little bit different, right? And that's what we've got. Today, I'm going to be talking to somebody a little bit about Arsenal because they are an Arsenal fan, but mostly we're talking about talking, which sounds a little bit weird, but when you're talking about talking to one of the best interviewers in the game, well, then it becomes a different thing altogether. My guest today on the show is Donald McRae, who's an author and journalist who grew up in South Africa and who I'm sure many of you read every week in The Guardian. He does a long-form interview with somebody from the world of sports, usually. They're always enlightening, always interesting, and he has a brilliant ability to get to the very heart of a person. And it's not always easy to do. You know, there are lots of people who do interviews but don't necessarily get what they should or get what they could out of somebody. And Donald has this remarkable talent to be able to connect with people and also to approach the people that he's talking to in a very fair and open-minded way. Because sometimes, you know, the subjects of an interview can be difficult. Maybe not the nicest people in the world. Maybe they're very guarded for different reasons. Maybe they're traumatized. Maybe there's something going on in their life that doesn't allow them to open up. And he has this talent to be able to get them to do that. So I wanted to talk to him about that, but also talk to him about his life growing up in South Africa, what it was that made him an Arsenal fan. And it's quite an unusual story as to why he became an Arsenal fan, certainly not the conventional route, particularly as we're talking about South Africa in the 1970s. Donald has also written, I think, 11 books at this point. There was one out last year, which if you haven't read, I can't recommend it highly enough, called A Man's World, the story of Emile Griffith, who was a world champion boxer, and his story. But he's written about people like Jesse Owens and Joe Louis, the world of boxing with Mike Tyson, Don King, Oscar De La Hoya. He's twice won the William Hill Sports Book of the Year, and I think it's a very interesting conversation with a man who's produced some very, very fine work down the years, and long may he continue to do so. So this is my conversation with Donald McRae.
Mm-hmm.
to start by talking about a little bit about where you came from, and that was South Africa. You were born in South Africa, and one of the things that's always struck me from reading the interviews that you do and some of your books and the way that you talk to people and about people is that there always seemed to me to be a real sense of fairness to the way that you try and present the story, whatever it is. It's not always an easy story. Is that a consequence of having grown up in a country and in a society that really wasn't fair?
It's a good point, and I haven't thought about that for a while, but I think the answer is unequivocally yes. I think South Africa in the 1960s and 70s, when I was a kid, epitomized injustice and inequality and lack of fairness. And I think as I, you know, when I was living out in South Africa, I was a huge Arsenal fan at the time, but I was full of teenaged angst against apartheid, and I would vent a lot of spleen, a bit like, you know, the kind of people who are on Arsenal fan TV now. That was me back in the 70s. But I learned after a while that actually it's far better to just take a step back and attempt to listen to people with compassion and give them a chance to voice their viewpoints. So yeah, clearly I think my South African past and that injustice of that past has influenced my sort of outlook on life.
Yeah, and as a place to grow up though, filled with sport, and you write in your website that you're a huge sports fan as well as music fan and everything else. Yeah. I mean, how was it from that point of view to sort of live within the confines of that society, but still enjoy things that, like the rest of us over here, would, I guess, in a way, take for granted, just their part and parcel of normal society?
It was a bizarre sort of time when I look back at it. It was a little like living in sort of Beverly Hills in Los Angeles, palatial homes, swimming pool. We didn't have a swimming pool. All my friends had swimming pools. The weather was gorgeous. So it was a fantastically privileged life we had. Good education, access to all kinds of music and sport. But at the same time, our houses were filled with black people who we call them servants. So it was quite by the time I was about 10 or 11, I was starting to think this is kind of bizarre that people I knew so well who worked in the house for my family, they could only have their cup of coffee in their own mug. They couldn't use the mugs that my mother and father and my sister and I used. Mm. They had to use their own black mug. And that just that little tiny note of domesticity started me thinking, and I started to work out this is quite a warped society. And I think that's kind of where slowly my political consciousness developed. And certainly sport was a huge thing because South Africa was subjected to a sports boycott.
Yeah.
And we all love sport. And when we couldn't play international sport, I would say to my dad, but why? My dad would say, well, it's because of the way the world perceives us. And I'd say, well, why don't they like us? And my dad said, well, that's because of apartheid. So sport was, again, a huge factor in opening up my mind and seeing the injustice that sort of enveloped us in South Africa.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, I think it's not everybody wakes up to that, do they? Not everybody has that realization, because sometimes when you're brought up in a certain way, what is normal or what you're used to is normal. Yeah. You don't think about it being right or wrong, but to have the sense of, well, this is not right.
Well, I think for me, it was sort of, you know, I loved people like Muhammad Ali, and most of my teachers at school would say, wow, isn't Ali a fantastic fighter? Isn't he an amazing person? And we'd say, but sir, he's black. How do you feel about that? And they would say, oh, well, he's not one of our blacks. You know, there was a distinction between a South African black and a fantastic guy like Muhammad Ali, who was almost beyond color. So again, that's when my anger started to surface, because they could not see kind of the hypocrisy of their statements. But for me, who loved music, especially black music, again, that meant I couldn't easily accept apartheid. By the time I was sort of in my teens, the injustice could not be just turned to one side. So music and sport were huge factors in opening up my mind.
Yeah, and music and sport as well are incredible ways of breaking down those divisions, whether it's conscious or not, in a way, you know, black sports people or black musicians can cross over into the consciousness of, into a society where they're not necessarily welcomed, you know, and it's their the talent and people look beyond perhaps skin color for those reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I got disappointed and upset when, you know, other people who, mainly sort of older than me, say teachers who could exalt Ali or Pele, but then would step back and say, well, yeah, that's sport and they don't live here. And therefore, you know, we're still going to perpetuate our sort of prejudice towards black people living in our own society.
Yeah.
And yet, as I said, it was kind of weird because our houses were filled with black people who, you know, looked after the kids, were part of the family in many ways. And it was just a weird, weird society. And fortunately, apartheid, although there's still division between black and white economically in South Africa, at least that basic naked apartheid system has long gone.
So is that in some ways why, I mean, you turned your teenage angst, as you described it, into something a bit more positive? You were a teacher for a while.
Yeah, I was a teacher sort of in my early 20s. This was sort of in the 1980s, partly as a way of escaping the army, because in apartheid, as a white South African, you had to go into the army for 2 years and then do 9 camps, and you'd be fighting on the border in places like Angola where there was a war going on. So it was a bit like the Vietnam situation in the US in the 1960s. And one way of staying out of the army was just to be a student for as long as possible.
Yeah.
So I kept doing that until I was about 21. And I then thought I'd quite like to earn a little bit of money. And a friend of mine, who was a woman from London who lived in Johannesburg at the time, she suggested that when I go into Soweto to teach, and suddenly all my fears came to the fore. I was thinking, but Soweto, that's full of 1 million black people, no whites are allowed in. And she said, well, you're always talking about apartheid not being good. Why don't you go see if you can do something good? So I called up a black school, and I think initially they thought I was going to be a spy because they were not used to any white person wanting to come work for them. And again, how sport and music helped me. On my first morning as a teacher, after they accepted my application, they took me into a little shebeen, which is like as you understand in Ireland, a sort of a drinking den.
Yeah.
This was 8 o'clock in the morning, and there were pictures of fantastic black sportsmen, black musicians that I could immediately start talking about, and I felt at home. And I had a wonderful 2 years in Soweto. And I think I learned much more than I actually taught.
Right.
But again, it was the shaping of me, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, that there must have been a huge amount to learn. As much as you can see the division in society and you can see the people that worked in your house and worked with your family, you're sort of right in the middle of it. You're seeing it from a different perspective then. I mean, there must have been, it must have been hugely life-changing to see it from that perspective.
It was absolutely, because suddenly I had black people who had become my friends. Beforehand, they always worked for my family, or you went into a shop and a black person would serve you. But suddenly I was working with fellow teachers in Soweto, and I just got to know these people so well, and I would go to parties with them, I'd hang out with them, and suddenly I'd look at a young black woman, I was in my early 20s, and I think, wow, she's quite a good-looking girl. And I would attempt to use my charm, which didn't work too often, but sometimes it did. But, you know, suddenly, Andrew, that just changes your perceptions, because you're now with people, you know, who are equal to you and better than you in many ways. So it had a huge seismic impact on my perception of life. In South Africa.
So you moved to England to avoid conscription. There was never any thought in your mind that this was something that you were going to do to fulfill that national service.
No, I was. By the time I was about 12, I knew I would never go in, and it caused a lot of pain in our family, because my family knew I would have to leave. The only other alternative was to go to jail, which was a 6-year sentence. And I used to, when I was 15, 16, sort of, you know, fired up and say, oh, I'm going to go into jail for 6 years, and hard for my mother and father to hear that. But I think deep down I was far too scared, and I couldn't face the idea of being in jail for 6 years. But at the same time, I shouldn't make it out as a hardship, because the lure of coming to overseas, as we called it, into a place like London, me as an Arsenal supporter, to the idea of actually seeing Arsenal live, yeah, was a wonderful magnet for me. And to go to gigs in the 1980s, I was so excited to see subtitled films. It was a huge adventure for me to come to the UK. So although it was painful for me to leave South Africa, because when I left, it was with the implication I would not be able to go back home for many, many years.
How long was it before you were able to go back?
It wasn't too bad. It was only 4 years. I was able to go back in 1988, because things were starting to change then, and Mandela came out in 1990 out of jail after 26 years. But yeah, for those 4 years when I couldn't, it was hard, because it was a kind of an exile. Because I had no choice, and the British government kept wanting to kick me out, and I had to apply for political asylum here.
Blimey.
Even though I'm of Scottish descent, it was quite a complicated time. But at the same time, I was these were the days of Ian Allison was playing for Arsenal, and Don Howe was manager. It was not the most exciting time to be an Arsenal fan. It was the Charlie Nicholas days too, yeah, which was initially exciting. But then, you know, those mid-80s days as an Arsenal fan, there were a lot of disappointing days then. But it was fantastic for me just to be in London.
What was it that made you an Arsenal fan from that distance? Because I think, you know, we look now at the globalization of football, and also how easy it is, comparatively speaking, for people to be able to follow a team, you know, through websites, through blogs, through podcasts. The TV rights are sold all over the world. Fans can connect with each other. You know, we have people who visit Arsblog from literally every corner of the globe. They're part of, you know, what's now considered a big global Arsenal community. But in the 1980s, it wasn't quite that way. What was it about Arsenal that caught your eye?
Well, this all sounds shocking. Partly it shows how old I am, but it also is an insight into how backward South Africa was. Television was banned in South Africa until 1976. And I fell in love with Arsenal in 1969. I was 8 years old. Arsenal played Swindon. Oh. One of our most painful days as Arsenal fans, because Swindon were the old sort of third division, and famously or infamously beat Arsenal. And I saw a 5-minute clip before I went to a movie. They had something called Movieton News. They would have international highlights from all over the world. And because we didn't have television, it was so exciting for us to see a little clip of the outside world before we went to a movie. And they showed this couple of minutes highlight, black and white footage, obviously, of Arsenal against Swindon in the League Cup final. And normally kids support the winning team. And I don't know, it says something about my fucked up way of thinking. I ended up supporting the team who lost. And, well, I think I had a lucky escape then, because if I'd been a Swindon fan, even though I've been moaning this season a little bit about all kinds of things, I think being a Swindon fan, that would have been a heavy burden.
Yeah.
I had a wonderful time as an Arsenal fan. But that's how, I don't know why, I just chose to support Arsenal in 1969. And the only way I could follow it was on what was called the wireless in those days.
Yeah.
Saturday afternoons at about 6 o'clock in South African time, they'd switch to BBC World Service, and you would hear a game, and it was normally Leeds, because Leeds were kind of the dominant side then. But I would sometimes hear Arsenal on the wireless, which was so exciting. But more often than not, I wouldn't hear the score, so I would have to wait for the newspaper the following morning, dash to the corner shop, and they didn't have anything beyond the scores, and I would turn the page, and I'd see it would be Manchester City 1, Arsenal 0. The pain! So that's sort of how I kind of fell in love with Arsenal. It was a slow burn. But when I came in the 1980s, suddenly, you know, I could go each week.
Yeah.
The only you could turn up on the North Bank, you know, half an hour early at 2:30, pay your £4, So my son is a huge Arsenal fan, and you know, when I tell him these kind of things, he finds it hard to believe. But that's sort of how my own personal sort of Arsenal love affair.
Sure. I mean, maybe that's a theme that runs through your work, this seeking out the underdog in a way, or rejecting the winner, I guess, when you look at what happened against Swindon that time. And look, we've had some of those moments down the years.
And certainly have.
Yeah, you know, but it's part and parcel of the Arsenal experience, I think. You can't, you, I don't know, well, you'd like to live without it, but you just can't, because they don't let you. But when you came to the UK then, what was your intention in terms of, what were you, 23, 24, something like that?
Just had my 23rd birthday. Mm. And I'd always said to my mother and father, I'm going to become an author. And in hindsight, you know, it was totally an insane thing to say, because I didn't know anyone outside of South Africa. I came to London. I had one contact at the NME, the old music paper, because I used to have a fanzine, which was sort of local music in South Africa. And I'd sent it to an NME journalist and said, I'm coming to England. I'd love to work for the NME, because, you know, 1980s, a lot of people loved the NME.
Yeah.
And he sort of said, oh, I quite like your fanzine. Come, let's meet. So he was my one contact when I came in 1984, a guy called Barney Hoskins, who's a wonderful music writer. And Barney sort of said, you know, why don't you, I'll speak to the sort of editor and see if you can maybe do a few little gigs. And within a couple of weeks, I was going to see bands for the NME, and yeah, I had my 250 words, which I would slave over all day to get those 250 words. So I feel your pain on a daily basis doing AskBlog. I know what it's like. But that gave me so much impetus, and that started me off. And you know, and I'm now working, although I do work for The Guardian and do the interviews, mainly I'm working as an author. And so somehow it's kind of worked out, which is hard to believe.
Was it always your intention to go down the non-fiction road, or did you have ambitions of perhaps being a novelist? I suppose maybe that's the distinction between...
I had the whole mythology of being a novelist. That's clearly, that's what I always said. I wanted to be a novelist. And I did for many years. But then I started doing books. My first book was on the sex business in London. My second book was on boxing, with people like Mike Tyson, who I spent 5 years following people like Tyson. And I suddenly started to think, well, actually, real life is so evocative and compelling, and I'm meeting these highly unusual people. They're far more compelling than anyone I could imagine. And then I started to do books, some which were set further back in time. I did books about criminal lawyers. I did books about Jesse Owens and Joe Lewis. So for me, sitting in my little shed in the garden, it's quite exciting, because I could go back to Chicago in the 1920s, or I could, you know, be with Mike Tyson at the height of his infamy. And it's been a wonderful opportunity for me working in nonfiction, because I've met some unusual people, whether it's in sport, politics, all kinds of fields of life. I feel, you know, amazingly lucky to have had these opportunities.
I think that's a really interesting phrase that you use there, unusual people, because if you say that to somebody, you say that that's an unusual person, you would think he's a bit strange, or he's a weirdo, or stay away from him. But perhaps the fact that this is somebody who, let's say Mike Tyson, who is at the very top, or was at the very top of his game, the most famous boxer in the world at the time, just by its very nature, that is in itself unusual, and comes with all this baggage, or comes with all the things that make that person, because they're very rare.
And especially, you know, Tyson, when I got to know him, it was just before he went into jail, and he was fighting for like $30 million a fight, and he had little education, but he was clearly intelligent. So I immediately was interested in him, because when I spoke to him, his answers were so evocative and kind of deep thinking, which a lot of people say, oh, Mike Tyson, of course, he's just a thug. And he is a thug. Many times in his life, he has been a despicable thug. But there's another side to Mike Tyson, that if you can get beyond sort of the thuggishness of him and the lunacy of boxing in Las Vegas, where he's making $30 million, I found a human being that was quite complex and damaged. And again, my South African past was enormously helpful to me, because initially he heard my accent and he said, "You're not English." I said, "No." He said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Johannesburg." And he just kind of burst out laughing. And he said, "You, South African, coming to talk to me, Mike Tyson?" And but immediately we had this kind of bond, and he started asking me a few questions. So the whole, instead of a question-answer interview, it became a conversation. That was enormously helpful to me. And I think I also, from South Africa, had learned not to make quick judgments.
Yeah.
Because the whole of South African society was based on a quick judgment: what color are you? And I think that informed my interaction with people, that I thought, well, I'm going to give whoever I meet a chance just to, you know, engage with each other and see whether I can make up my own mind if I like this person.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that's extremely relevant now, because even in this day and age, everything appears to be very binary, doesn't it? You know, a person is one thing and that's the only thing that they are. And you talk about trying to find the humanity behind a person who's done bad things and despicable things, as you say. It's not always easy to do that. It's not easy. I think in ways we're being, I won't say controlled by the media, but this idea that you have to put somebody in a compartment, you have to put them in a box, and they can't exist outside of that box, that this one thing or one character trait or one event or just one thing they might have said, that's what defines them in the public consciousness. And the reality, of course, is that even the worst people are human.
Of course, there's always multifaceted aspects to each person, and it's not that one should soft soap your depiction of a person who's done bad things. It's important to actually confront that person and say, and I would with Tyson, I did say to him, "You have done these things," and slowly admissions would come and confessions would come, and not that he needed to confess to me anything, but I think totally what you're saying, Andrew, is on the button, is that now these days, over the last sort of 15 years maybe, people like to have the simplistic little box: this is good, this is bad. And as we know, life is full of all kinds of nuances and shades and subtleties. People are always different, shifting personas, and I always attempt to get to what I hopefully can find the core person within them, many persona they might use, and this is particularly famous people might use to sort of obscure things. And it's amazing with people, if you show them sort of decency and you listen to them, sometimes you can then ask more difficult questions and then they will answer you.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people have a public persona that's in some ways a shield from I guess, looking to inside themselves, from introspection in a way. Sometimes it's there very obviously, because it's like if you look at someone, I would say, like Conor McGregor, there's a public persona there that feels very, it's an artifice, it's very, very manufactured. But other people have a persona that perhaps is there to protect them in a way, because they don't trust what people might say or what people might think if they let the real them be seen.
Yeah, and they, I guess, are hurting inside, and this persona can become like a shield to deflect attention or to scare off people. But I think, yeah, definitely Conor McGregor, I have interviewed him, and he's fascinating. He's a wonderful talker. But I haven't had enough time with him to sort of see the actual genuine Conor beyond the bluster. And Don King would be a wonderful example. Is I was with King many times, and you know what King was like at his peak of bluster, and he would be misquoting Shakespeare, highly amusing and fascinating to be with him, but it can also wear you down and be exhausting. But there were many times where I'd be with King, and he'd be talking to 1,000 people, and he would be turning on the charm and the big words, and then suddenly you get into the limousine with Don King, and it'd just be you and him, and like a shutter would come down, and all that nonsense stopped.
Mm.
It suddenly started talking to you just in quite a calm, deadpan kind of voice, and just say, "I'm so tired," he would say. And also Chris Eubank, another kind of boxer who has a persona. But actually, if you're one-to-one with Eubank, and he's not doing an interview, he talks like a normal person.
Mm.
And so I was quite fascinated how these kind of people, larger-than-life figures, use their persona to sell things, to deflect attention from them, their deepest core. But I guess, yeah, those worlds, boxing, UFC, always lends themselves to...
I mean, that's
life figures.
That's what I was going to ask you, because so much of it is about how you're perceived and how you're seen. You can't be seen to be weak, and I think that was evident in the book that you wrote last year, the one that was released last year, A Man's World, the story of Emile Griffith, which is it's a book. When I was reading it, I was thinking, oh my God, I mean, this is a guy who just cannot be true to himself, who's dealing with so many inner demons, not least because in a sense, when he tried to obscure who he was with the machismo, with the fury of fighting, he caused such damage to another man that was something that lived with him as well. It was like layering this trauma on top of a trauma because of the world that he existed in, because he was a gay man who couldn't come out. He was a world champion boxer, and given the time he lived in, he just couldn't. It's, I think we like to think now that we're more enlightened, but back then it must have just been a traumatic life.
Well, you know, I was kind of shocked, and even me coming out of South Africa, where it was such a, as I said earlier, unbelievable world that people were defined by the color of their skin. But I was shocked when I started working on that particular book to, you know, Emil in the 1960s, he was living in New York. And the fact that homosexuality was banned, you know, in the 1960s and even the early 1970s, even in the state of New York, which we always think is a bastion of freedom and liberty, I was just gobsmacked by that. And then the whole idea that here we have a young black world champion boxer who happens to be gay. I just started thinking, wow, this must have been so difficult for him. And then to meet sort of people who were close to him at the time gave me such an insight into these two worlds that he occupied, both defined by men. One was a world of violence, boxing, attempting to beat up an opponent. And the other world was full of, I guess, fun and love. And he was a gay man. That's where he found his love amongst other men. And these two worlds were so opposite. And I felt enormously moved many times whilst working on that particular book.
Mm. It's an absolutely fantastic book. I'd recommend it to anybody who's looking for something to read in the sports sphere. It's absolutely brilliant. Right, we've got to take just a very, very short little break here in the middle. We're going to come back and talk to Donald a little bit more about interviews, the art of interviewing, and everything else right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Now, when it comes to interviews, at what point did you, or did you at any point, realize that you have a real ability to talk to people in a way that gets a story from them? Because, you know, interviews are 10 a penny and interviewers are 10 a penny, but really good interviewers, I'm not trying to blow smoke up your arse here, are quite rare. In some ways, you remind me a little bit of Marc Maron. I don't know if you listen to Marc Maron's podcast. There's a sort of natural ability to get stories from people because they feel like they can talk to you. Are you or were you aware of that?
I think I was lucky in the sense that I started to learn how to interview people as an author. I wasn't a journalist as such. I was working on my books. And so I would be spending years with people, and I started to get to know them well. And I'm actually essentially quite, even though I'm waffling away here, babbling away, I'm quite a shy person essentially. And I sometimes find it quite difficult to ask hard questions. So sometimes I would talk more about myself and I would be bumbling and I'd be knocking over my coffee onto Mike Tyson's new $1,000 mink coat. There were a few moments like that. I was a total buffoon. But actually that helped because I think they saw my kind of weaknesses and my failings. And that meant their defenses came down. And then I suddenly started to work out actually the best way to interview someone is to take away any feeling, well, this is my perspective, that they are not on their guard. Because if they are on their guard, they're going to attempt to say as little as possible. Mm. But if they feel comfortable with you, then they're more likely to open up. And I still go into my interviews these days, hopefully with good intentions, to be fair to that person. But I think I also, perhaps there's a little artifice going on that I do attempt to settle them and make them feel that I'm not actually out to persecute them or hound them. And because of that, they seem to feel a bit more comfortable. Mm. And then sometimes they can say things in a normal bog standard media interview they wouldn't say. So it's a mix of being a bit of a bumbler sometimes and also hopefully with some honesty in the way I deal with people and hopefully a semblance of being fair to them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very important thing that, you know, being able to present or the person you're talking to feeling confident that they're not going to be misrepresented whenever it is they tell you things that they're going to tell you. I think that's a really, really big part of it. I mean, you obviously, when you go and interview somebody, sometimes you're going for something quite specific. You know, there are specific reasons or there's a specific story behind that. But I mean, are you also happy if during the course of the conversation it goes somewhere completely different? I mean, I think that's probably an important part of it too, is being able to move in a tangent away from perhaps what you thought you were going to get and you go and get something different or perhaps something better.
Yeah, I think that's where sometimes the best interviews happen. You go in with a set idea, and I always go in with a long list of questions. I normally have about 50 or 60 questions, which is a bit disconcerting for the poor person opposite me. They see all these questions. But more than likely, that person sometimes will take us down a new tangent, which is far more fascinating than I had initially been thinking my questions were. So, yeah, I think, Andrew, it's so important, like anything in life, to be open, to be flexible, and to listen. I think that's the key thing I learned, actually, is to listen to people. It's not about me. No one actually cares about what my perceptions are of whoever I might be interviewing next week. It's far more important to give space to that interviewee to talk so he or she can tell us a little bit about what's going on in their world. And if you listen closely, like, I'm not blowing smoke up your ass here now, but the fact you've been listening in our sort of discussions here, and you've led me down paths I wasn't expecting to go down this afternoon. If you listen, it can then open up an interview into a much more meaningful exchange, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it's quite an experience sometimes, isn't it, that if you're talking to somebody and you're thinking, okay, you know, you have your list of questions. I'm really not as prepared as you are. I didn't have 50 or 60 questions for you. And I, you know, I've got some notes scribbled down here, but I tend to, as much as possible, allow the thing to go in whatever direction it's going to go in, you know. And it is really nice when that happens, because sometimes, you know, I've done interviews and I've done podcasts, you know, football and otherwise, and you sit down and you talk to somebody and then you go, wow, we've been speaking for 45 minutes or 50 minutes or an hour, and it's somebody you've never met before. Maybe even somebody that you were perhaps a little bit intimidated or nervous about talking to, and you realize that just by talking and listening and having a conversation, you've passed a really pleasant and enjoyable hour.
Yeah. Absolutely. And those are the exciting moments. So that's why I still, you know, my wife is sometimes saying to me, when are you going to stop doing these interviews? And I still love it, because sure, there are the odd bum one where it's kind of hard work. But most of actually, there are moments you can be doing an hour long interview. So often the case, especially with sportsmen and women who are so used to being interviewed, you might be going the first 30 minutes thinking, Jesus, this is so dull. It's going nowhere. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, the guy just, or the woman just says something, and you think, wow, that's kind of unusual. And then they take you down to somewhere totally new, and it's not just about them being a sportsman or sportswoman, but they're talking about themselves as human beings and adversity they've faced, things they still like to do. And suddenly, you know, out of an hour-long interview, there might only be 10 minutes that is kind of special, but those 10 minutes can be so intense and so compelling. Mm. Suddenly, when it for me to then put it down on paper at my laptop, it's actually quite easy, because those 10 minutes are so moving and involving. But yeah, there might be 50 minutes of kind of anodyne, bog standard stuff as well.
It's what's your process when you, on a daily basis, are you someone who writes every day, or? You know, I certainly, from my point of view, I write every single day, and I would feel very strange if I didn't. But then I am expected to, in a way. But you're doing something on a weekly basis, more or less, for The Guardian. And then when the books are coming out, you know, people understand that there's a lot of writing goes into books, but we don't see the end product of that for, you know, months and months at a time. Yeah. But, you know, is it something that you have to do every day, in a way?
I do. And I think there's a couple of, I'm working on a couple of things simultaneously book-wise, and it has meant that I'm working sort of 7 days a week. And I've been doing this for many, many months now. Besides New Year's Day, I haven't had a day off for about 5 months. But because it doesn't actually feel like work, because it's so different, whether it's the interviews, there's always someone new. And the books, you know, with it being nonfiction, as we've touched on, I'm doing such diverse subjects, and as I've got a couple of things going on at the moment, and the deadlines are such that I have to work each day, which lends a liberty, because, and for you too, I think, and often, you know, my day, I might have been going for a few hours, and then I'll stop and have a coffee, and then I'll click onto my Ask Blog daily, and I'll be thinking, gosh, Andrew's done it again. And it's, you know, I just think, like you, there's not a choice, and it's something, well, there is a choice in the sense that we want to do this, but the fact that it's kind of cast in stone that you will do this on a daily basis, and for me, I have deadlines to meet, and they're quite harsh, demanding deadlines. I've just got to do it. And if there's no choice to meet your deadline, or the way you work on a, you know, there's a daily blog, it actually just means you get on and do it.
Yeah.
And that helps a lot. And a lot of people, you know, there's so many talented people out there who could do wonderful work. People who haven't perhaps got a commission to do a book, or they don't have a sort of journalistic assignment, but are just doing things sort of in the hope that it will get seen somewhere on a blog. It's much harder to have that discipline, I think.
Yeah.
And I always say to people, just do it. Just go out there, do your blog as often as you want to and as often as you can. And even if it's only being seen by a few people, you'll get that, you know, it will slowly get noticed. And I mean, I guess with you, when you first started, there weren't too many people, you know, clicking on to Arsblog all those years ago.
No.
Whereas now, obviously, you know there's so many, many people each day looking
sure.
at your blog.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things. I get emails quite a lot from people and, you know, from students and from people who want to be sports journalists and those kind of people who will email me and say, look, how did you make Arsblog so big? How did it happen? You know, what's the trick? And I was going, well, there's no trick.
It's insane.
It's 15 years old. So that's kind of what you got to do. You know, you got to do it every day and be consistent and be frequent with the stuff that you produce. And, you know, a lot of them do go away and set up blogs. And, you know, I know I've had some emails back from people who've gone places from having set up a blog and started writing and honed their craft in a certain way because just they've been practicing writing, which is
yeah,
already.
Yeah, I think the discipline helps, and you also get better. And if you just do anything, and I think it does. You just need to put in a lot of years of work. I mean, my first book was published in 1992, and I'm on my 11th and my 12th now. But it's because it's something I love doing. The hard work, actually, you can get it. You can just about do it.
Yeah.
And with you, with Arsenal, kind of labor of love. But, you know, that's part of who you are. And I think we are so lucky. And that's why when young people, I don't want to start patronizing here, but when, you know, young people do send you emails or contact you, like you've been talking about people contacting you, I always attempt to be kind of enthusiastic and supportive because it is hard. And I think now I'm in such a privileged position that I you know, I'm able to do these things that I love doing. But starting out, I think now, even though with the modern, you know, with blogs and podcasts, there's so many opportunities and you're not dependent on big publishers. You can go out there and do it.
Yeah.
But also, it's hard because there's so much noise. There's so much stuff going about that how does a young person starting out with their blog or podcast, how do they get noticed?
Well, you know what, though? From having listened to Mark Maron's podcast quite a lot, and one of the things that always strikes me is again, we go back to the humanity of people, and you listen to famous actors or singers or musicians or comedians, whoever it is that he has on, the one common factor, I think, is that all the people that somehow got a break or got a noticed or got an album that got picked up or got a comedy show that got picked up or, you know, they were doing things. They were actually doing it. And that's, I think, where that's the first step, isn't it, is to be out there and to be producing things or trying to make your way rather than talking about, well, I would like to do this or I would like to. I mean, I'm sure you've met loads of people who say, oh, I'd love to write a book. I'd love to. Well, you know,
just
I know it's not easy, but, you know, really, that's what it comes down to is kind of just do it. Look, a couple of quick things before we finish up here. It's probably a question that you're asked a lot, and it might be a bit cheesy, but I know what my answer to this question would be. But if you could interview anybody, and I don't mean alive or dead, I mean anybody now that you haven't interviewed, and your list is much shorter than mine because you've interviewed loads of them, who would you like to sit down with over a prolonged period and try and get something out of?
Well, this is going to sound so cheesy, one Arsenal fan to another, but Arsene Wenger has been top of my wish list for the last 20 years. And, you know, Arsene Wenger does not give any one-to-one interviews to sort of UK media. And, you know, via you, I saw the Men in Blazers little interaction, the stuff he did there.
Yeah.
And I just thought that he would be, and putting aside the turmoil that he is in at the moment, which, of course, I'd like to ask him, what is he doing? And is he going to go? But putting that to one side, I would just be fascinated to spend a lot of time with Arsene Wenger if I could. And I'm someone who has now, I think, slightly moved into the camp where I feel he has to go. Personally, that's my own view, kind of measured view, but I think it's a view that perhaps you sort of articulated in Arsblog. Time is now that we need a change. But as a man, as a manager, looking back over what he has done, I would he would be the person I'd like to interview more than anyone else. But that's kind of sad, shows me as a one-dimensional Arsenal fan.
No, I mean, that's absolutely what I was going to say. Not Arsene Wenger now, because I don't think you can get to the very heart of or the truth of Arsene Wenger right now, because there's so much going on. There's self-preservation. There are things that he says, I think, to maybe protect himself, but also to protect the club and to protect some of the players. But I think post-Arsenal, Arsene Wenger is due a good Donald McCraying, if you don't mind me saying so. That would be an amazing thing to read. But it strikes me that it wouldn't be an interview. An interview would not do that justice. I think we're in book territory here.
Well, it would have to be a long old interview. And yeah, exactly as you say, if it was an interview where I'd be interviewing him now as Arsenal manager, it would be impossible. But yes, if you could take those shackles off and have him talking one day about all he's done, that would be fascinating.
Really would. All the stuff that we're like dying to ask, and all the questions from the stadium, and all the things that have happened down the years, you know, it would be amazing. But look, Donald,
hopefully he would stop saying that's fake news, because that's one thing I've been thinking, give that one up, Arsene. But
I agree with that one. Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much indeed for your time. Obviously, you've told us how busy you are working 7 days a week. So for taking the time out and chatting to me on the podcast, I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Without being too cheesy, it's been an honor being on the podcast. So thanks a lot.
Thanks, Donald. Well, there you go. Thank you very much indeed to Donald McCrae. If you don't know his stuff, you can find him on The Guardian every week. He does the interview there. Go seek one out, click his name, and you get access to just an amazing archive of brilliant interviews. You can also read his books. If you want more details of those, you can find them on his website, which is donaldmccrae.com. And if you want to follow him on Twitter, he is at Donald G. McCrae. That is at Donald G. McCrae. Hope you enjoyed that. Maybe took your mind off all the goings on at Arsenal, or the lack of goings on, and everything else. You know, we could all use a bit of a distraction. Have a great weekend. James and I will be here on Monday with an Arscast extra for you. God knows what we're going to be talking about, but, you know, we'll figure something out. So join us for that on Monday. But until then, have a great weekend. Talk to you on the next one. Cheers. Bye-bye.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, a statement from Stan Kroenke. Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.